Okay. Like I said, I printed out the lecture outline and handouts. I haven't printed out the notes yet. Just got this done real quick. And here, either later this morning or Monday, I'll get a bunch more of this stuff put up on the website. I'm running a little behind on that. But today we're going to start on the atheragote groups, or the wingless groups. But does anybody have any questions before we start on that? So, say atheragota. A means not, terra means wing. So these are the non-winged groups. We usually also say that they're primitively wingless. We make that distinction because there'll be other groups later on in the class, for example, fleas and things like that, that are also wingless, but they're not primitively wingless. They evolved from winged ancestors and lost their wings, whereas these groups we're talking about today, they never had wings, their ancestors never had wings, and so we call them primitively wingless. From here on out is what we used to call the insecta, but now things have kind of changed, and I'll put up here. Black marker seems to be over here. Now it's what we call the hexapoda. Hex meaning six, poda meaning feet. So these are the six-legged groups. Now, as I said, there's been changes in this classification over the years, and most of it does involve these more primitive older groups. And now we actually split the hexapoda. There's several groups that have the mouth parts that are internal. They're not out, you know, if you think about most insects, you can see the mandibles of your tiger beetles, or you can see the siphoning mouth parts of the butterfly. The things are out where you can see them. Some of these lower primitive groups, the mouth parts are actually in a pouch inside the head, so they're not external. And so we call those the entognatha. Ento meaning inside or inner, natha meaning jaws. Within the entognatha, there's three orders that we talk about. There's the Protura, the Columbula, and third one, just lost my mind, but it's the Diplura. So those three have internal mouth parts. Everything else has external mouth parts. So they are sometimes called the ectonatha. But this is also now what many people now refer to as the insecta. Okay. So three that have mouth parts internal. Everything else from here on out has mouth parts external. Now, this we sometimes split into two. There's one order where the mandibles only have a single articulation with the head. So the mandibles, they are attached to the head at just one point. I mean, there's one joint where it revolves around. So that they call that the monocondylia, and the only order is the microcorypha. Everything else besides that, the mandibles have two points of articulation, two joints. And so, of course, yep, those are the dicondylia. within the dicondylia, there's still one order, the Thysanura, that is primitively wingless. Everything else has wings. And so this would be the Pterygota. Whereas all of this, from the very beginning down to the Thysanura, is what they would call the Pterygota. Does that all make sense? So, again, the Hexapoda can, is what everything we're talking about from here on out. Three orders have internal mouth parts: Protura, Calimbula, Diplura. That's the Entonatha. Everything else has external mouth parts called the Insecta or Ectonatha. Within that group, one order has one point of attachment in the mandibles, Microcorypha. Everything else has two. Within that, there's still one order that's primitively wingless, the Thysanura, and then everything else is the more advanced insects. So again, today we begin our discussion of the Hexapoda. These are the six-legged arthropods. A lot of the stuff we've already talked about, but things that define the Hexapoda, they have the three distinct body regions: the head, the thorax, and the abdomen. They usually have one pair of antennae. Sometimes, well, as we'll see, the antennae are lacking or missing, but most time they have one pair of antennae. Mouth parts, there's usually one pair of mandibles, one pair of maxillae, a hypopharynx, and a labium. There may be others parts too. The genital reproductive organs are at the posterior end of the abdomen. And there's no locomotor appendages on the abdomen. They're all on the thorax. Again, we think that the Hexapoda may be had arisen. We used to say the Anelida. Now we just say kind of a myriapod type ancestor, something that had legs on every segment. Those in the head region evolved to become the mouth parts. There's a lot of debate on how many segments actually fuse together to form the head. We won't get into that in this class. We do that in morphology. Mm-hmm. And then right behind the head, the next three segments, the appendages evolved into the walking legs, mm-hmm. and then the rest became the abdomen, where the legs disappeared. As we'll see, a lot of the groups today, though, still have what they think are vestiges of those old legs on the abdomen, little styli in that. So, that will bring us to our first order we'll talk about, is the Protura. And this is where I now we'll switch back to the overhead. Look at. Protura, what does the order name mean? It's all in front of you. The T actually goes with the proto. Mm-hmm. And so then it's just Ura. You don't know what Ura? Mm.
Ura, off the top of my head, I do not know.
Means tail. Okay. So this is the first tail. A little bit later, we'll have the Thysanura. Thysan means bristle, so they're the bristle tails. So anything that ends in Ura usually means tail. So.
I will admit, I did not know any of that when I was learning Thysanura.
Yeah. So, anyway, they're commonly called Proturans or Telson tails. The order name means first tail. Mm-hmm. They are very tiny and small, and so they weren't discovered until relatively recently. The first ones were described in about 1909 or so. They do occur worldwide. There's about 200 known species. They occur in Fargo. They're usually whitish in color, very small. We're talking about a half a millimeter to 2 millimeters in length. Difficult to see even under a microscope sometimes. Somewhat elongate in shape. Head is pronathous. The mouth parts, or the head's directed anteriorly. The mouth parts are internal, kind of sectorial. The eyes, ocelli, and antennae are all missing. So they have no eyes, ocelli, or antennae. And yet you look at that picture in your handout and it sure looks like they kind of have antennae, don't they? Sticking out there in the front, forward. It's actually the first pair of legs they hold out in front of their head, and their first pair of legs have kind of gained a sensory function. So front legs are carried in a forward position and have gained a sensory function. Again, these are primitively wingless. The abdomen bears styli on the first three segments, if I recall. Kind of see them on this thing. I think like right there and right there and right there and right there are some of the styli, and then that's what's shown over here. These things are the styli. It's the underneath side of the abdomen. And they lack cerci, which we'll see some of the other groups have cerci. We know what cerci are, right? The kind of appendages coming off the very posterior end of the body.
What's the function of cerci?
A lot of times it's sensory, tactile. They can feel things with it. And occasionally we'll see some that have more forceps like cerci. They may use them to fight males or whatever. Mm-hmm. So metamorphosis is slight, or it's often called anamorphosis. Ana meaning no, so essentially no metamorphosis. What it means is the immatures and the adults essentially look the same, except the immatures are just a little bit smaller. Now, in the Proturans, however, they add abdominal segments each time they molt, or in many of the molts. They used to think that it was just one each time it molded that gained another segment, and they had names for them. The first one was called a proto-nymph, which had 9 segments. The second instar was called a deuto-nymph, deuto meaning 2, had 10 segments. The third one was called a trito-nymph, the third one.
I think I see where this is going.
Yeah, but more recent studies have really shown that it's a lot more complicated than that. That there goes through more molts than that, and there's once or twice they don't add segments, and then all of a sudden they may add 2 segments, and now they've given a lot more complicated names. There's a pre-larva, a larva, a larva 2, a maturus junior, a pre-imago, and then the imago, which again, I'm not expecting you guys to remember all that. It was the proto-nymph, deuto-nymph, and trito-nymph. You may see that. That was pretty well ingrained in things. And so I wanted you to hear about that. But the take-home is that they, during their molts, through their immatures, they do add segments at some of the molts anyway. Respiration is mainly cutaneous, not by the use of the trachea. They're so small. Small, tiny things, oxygen can just diffuse through the cuticle and gets to where it needs to by doing it that way. They don't have to have trachea carrying it all throughout their bodies. Like I said, they're easily overlooked because of their small size. They're not that rare, really, although we don't really find them that much in our Bergelese samples, but they are best found in the soil, peat, that a layer, woodland litter, turf, sometimes under stones or beneath bark. They feed on decomposing organic matter, and the best way is to collect them in Berlazy funnels. I think the data sheet I gave you or something may list three families or so, but we're not requiring any families to be recognized. We just hope that you can recognize a Protura if you see one. So we'll probably have some slides in that of some here. So anyway, that's the Protura. Hopefully you'll get some in some of it. We have occasionally, like I said, gotten some in our Berlazy samples, so, but you just got to look very carefully. So the next group we'll talk about is the Calembula. Now, the Calembula are a little bit bigger and more out in the open, so you probably have had these in your sweet nets and maybe didn't even know it, or maybe you did know it, but I saw some in my net yesterday, and I should have mentioned them. Calembula are commonly called the springtails. They're one of the oldest known hexapod groups. It's kind of hard to track these in the fossil record because soft-bodied things don't do well in the fossil record. But these were around in the Devonian period anyway. We know that. The order name, Calembula. Do we know what that means? Calembula. Calembula, calum means glue. And embola refers to wedge or that. And so they're kind of like the glue wedge or glue, you know, the glue wedge. What they're naming it for is on the underneath side of the body. We'll talk about this a little bit more in a minute. But there's a structure coming out of the underneath side right in here called the colophore. And originally, the first person, I think it was Daguerre, the first person who described these thought that this organ was used to attach to the substrate. It helped it stick to its substrate, so like crawling up a tree or crawling up a plant, it wouldn't fall off as easy. We now don't think that it probably doesn't have that function. We think that it functions in the uptake of water, which is kind of a reoccurring theme. A lot of one of the major problems insects, especially small insects, and that have is the keeping hydrated. They desiccate easily, and so. But anyway, they think this is a structure that uptakes water. The Calembula, again, are very small. They can be long and narrow shaped, or they can be shaped kind of like a ball. And we'll talk about that as we go more. The mouth parts are internal. The eyes may or may not be present, but if they are present, they're usually in a little group or patch of like simple eyes or ocelli. You can see on this, the upper left-hand corner of this handout, the group of eyes there. I think even up here there's the group of eyes. So just kind of like a patch of little simple eyes, if they're present at all.
Is there a particular body plan for their eyes, or just randomly distributed?
I don't know. I couldn't tell you.
It is. It's very interesting.
Yeah. So they form an eye patch consisting of up to one to several lateral ocelli. The antennae, again, usually are present but may not be, but they're usually fairly short and filiform, usually four-segmented. They lack the wings. These often do have some trachea, but again, most of the respiration is cutaneous. Now, the Calembula are interesting. Most of the time, they have six body segments, or six abdominal segments. That structure I just talked about, the colophore, is located on the first segment. Then on the third segment, they have a structure labeled on your handout here as the tenaculum. I think your textbook and other places sometimes call it the retinaculum. And it's, I guess I ought to use my color codes when we're doing. It would be this little, just little tiny, but this little red structure right there that I'm, well, I'm coloring it in red.
I thought that was a part of the illustration.
Huh?
I thought that was a part of like the, I thought that was a part of the dens.
So, and there'd be one, they're pointing to it, like right in here on that one too. So, and then on the fourth segment comes off this fork structure called the furcula. And so you can see it coming out here. And, well, the dens, that's probably the tooth of it, but that green thing, that whole thing is referred to as a furcula. Yeah, it's labeled over here on the right one. So what's going on, though, is that tenaculum is just a little catch that holds the furcula in place. And when something disturbs the columbillin, and thinks it may be about to be getting eaten or something, it starts applying a downward pressure with that tail-like furcula, and that retinaculum holds it in place, holds it in place, holds it in place, until it applies enough pressure, and then that tail-like thing snaps free, hits the ground, and propels the insect up in the air, and hence the common name springtails. So, now, as we'll see, some of the families, some of those structures are very reduced or absent, but that's the general game plan, ground plan for these things. These are in varied habitats. They're often, again, most commonly, again, in leaf litter and humus and soil, under bark of trees. But there's some that are, they kind of call them aquatic. They're not really under the water. They're on the surface of the water. And I've seen those in South Moorhead. Down there where the, I don't know how long you guys have been around to remember, down there where the Menards is, there used to be soccer fields down there. My kids played soccer down there on those fields where the Menards is now. But there was a little creek or low area went through there that had water in it. And you could see all the columbillin on top of that. There's some that are kind of marine. They're along the shoreline and get inundated when the water goes over them. There's also some that have a common name called snow fleas that come out, and they're active when it's real early in the spring when there's still snow. And what they're doing is when the snow is starting to melt and temperatures are starting to warm up, actually algae grows on the snow banks. And the columbillin will feed on that algae that's on the snow banks. I always had heard this, and yet you look at the snow and you say, there's algae here. But I remember flying in from someplace over the Fargo-Moorhead area early in the spring, and you could see all the snow banks. And from way up in the air, you could see the green on some of the sides of the snow banks. So,
and just, you know, pass them off.
Yeah, they're, like I said, you probably had them in your nets. And I was telling Aaron, if you're dumping your whole net contents into bags, you may have some in your plastic bags. So if not, you should still be able to go out and get some. Again, there's been some differences of opinion in the number of families and how they split the families up. We'll kind of go with the traditional classification and talk about a few notes here and there, but in general, columbillins, and I think Jerry's provided a table. Con, you got... You have this thing?
Yeah.
In a nutshell, and I'll talk about some of these families, but this table, maybe you have it, maybe you don't. If not, I'll get it. Okay, we'll... Yeah, okay, I'll have to make a copies and get this to you. But it's kind of a summary of what how we'll go through this. First of all, the Kalimbla, we can divide it into kind of like two suborders. And you can see these the names up on the top of your other sheets. But the first one is called the Symphypleona, which is essentially this first group. So Symphypleona. Can't spell. Again, it's at the top of some of your other sheets. Whereas from here down, it's the Arthropleona. And now again, some things of some minor things that we don't have to concern ourselves with, but in general, how we an easy way to separate these two is like it says, the abdomen is globular and the abdomen is elongate. And you can see the examples out to the right on this table. See how the bodies are more globular, the segments are actually more or less fused. Now I was going to say there's a new family that I think has one species that occurs way up in northern Canada that the body is more elongate, but I think the segments are fused. But again, we're not going to worry about that. So we have the Symphypleona, bodies more rounded and globular. Arthropleona, the bodies are more elongate and slender. This table lists two families, the Smithuridae and the Neelidae. I don't require the Neelidae, but an easy way to tell these two families apart is that the antennae are usually very short in the Neelidae and it's longer in the Smithuridae. Again, I'm going to go through each of these families. I'm just kind of give a summary here. The Arthropleona, first thing you would look at is whether you can, whether the first thoracic segment, the pronotum, is reduced or not. So in this upper group, the pronotum is sclerotized and you can see it. It's visible from above. Whereas these in the bottom, the pronotum is become more membranous and you can't see it. Yeah, it's kind of hard to tell with these pictures, but this one down here at the very bottom, you can see that the pronotum is very small in that, and it's like I said, it'd be membranous. Whereas these up here, the pronotum is sclerotized and much easier to see. And then I'll get down to the specifics of the how to tell the families apart as we go through. But anyway, the higher classification of the Kalimbla. If the body's globular, we go with the Symphypleona. If it's elongate, we go with the Arthropleona. Then within the Arthropleona, the first thing we do is look at that first segment behind the head, whether it's easily visible or whether it's not. Okay. I'll have to get that handout out to you. Now, in the Symphypleona, again, I already mentioned this, but the two families that we talk about, and you don't have to know the Neelidae. So, for the purpose of this class, and again, this is for tests and stuff, But if you see a Cleveland that's got the ball-shaped abdomen, the segments are fused, and so it looks like a glob, it'll be the Smithuridae. Now, when you're doing your collection, you got to be aware that you might catch some Neelidae too, but for test purposes, the Smithuridae. Again, this suborder has the four basal abdominal segments fused and indistinct. The fifth and sixth segments are often small, kind of papilla-like. See, you see these kind of like papillae. So the more posterior segments are more like just a papillus. Again, they contains three families, and now some, there's actually, it's called the Mackenzie Elidae. They're more elongate and slender, but again, I don't care about that. Smithurids, they're oval, globular in shape. Abdominal segments are fused to look like one big segment. They do have the dorsal papilla. Again, the antennae are usually longer than the head, whereas in the Neelidae, you can see the antennae are usually shorter than the head. Eyes are usually present. Again, a lot of these characters are in that table that I need to get to you. The family includes the economic pest, one called the garden springtail. And in Australia, there's one called the lucerne fly, or flea, lucerne flea. There's about 100 North American species. Then we go to the Arthropleona. See, it's spelled out up there. These are more elongate, slender. There's six distinct abdominal segments, so you can usually see the abdominal segments. Now, in these first three orders, or first three families, the prothorax is visible from above. So what you do is locate the front pair of legs, that's the pronotum, and you can see that it's easily visible from above. If you're looking down on these from above, you can easily see the top of the pronotum. Even here, you can see it going across here. Right there, you can see it. So these first group of three families have the pronotum more sclerotized, easy to see. The Podurity, we don't require this one in this class either. I mention it because it is the one that family that has the one that's on the surface of the water, the what they call aquatic. In fact, that's, I think, the only species in the family. There's only one species in the U.S., Podura aquatica, that lives on the surface of fresh water. Mm-hmm. The other two families, and this can be a little bit tough, but, and you notice that some in these families, the furcula is either absent or very reduced. But in the Onychiuridae, on its body will be these little circular things. This is a close-up of it down at the bottom left. And those are called pseudo-oculi, I believe. Pseudo-ocelli. Yeah, they call them pseudo-ocelli, which I don't know why, because they're not really ocelli. They also, this family also has this structure or organ right behind the antennae called a post-antennal organ. Now, from past times we were in the class, I don't think we really look for this post-antennal organ as much. But I do know we used to have a microscope slide where you could see these pseudo-ocelli on the abdomen. And so Jerry's usually, like I said, Jerry's good at cholembolids too. So he usually comes in and makes sure you guys see the pseudo-ocelli. The hypogastridae don't have the pseudo-ocelli, and they don't have that post-antennal organ. So hypogastridae, abdomen elongate, 6 distinct segments, prothorax visible. The antennae are usually shorter than the head. Furcula, if present, it's quite small. The hypogastridae is one of the largest families, over 200 North American species. And it's the group that contains the snow flea. So these have the snow flea. I guess I should have written on here the poduridae that we don't require you to recognize. That had the aquatic species. It's actually on the surface in water. Also in the hypogastridae is the marine species that I mentioned earlier. And then the onychiuridae, basically all there's the mentions again, they have that pseudo-ocelli. They also can exude their hemolymph when they're disturbed, which is kind of can be noxious. Predators don't like the taste of their hemolymph. So they can exude the hemolymph through those pseudo-ocelli, which is noxious. And then in the last two families, the last handout on the Calimbula, these are the ones now that the pronotum is very reduced, and so you can kind of see in these things here, you can see the sclerites and the pronotum would be up in here, so it's not very easy to see. Here, look, you can just tell that looks membranous. Again, it looks reduced there. Looks very reduced up in here. Mm-hmm. Even in there, it's just right up in there. So these two families, that first segment behind the head is membranous and very reduced, hard to see from above, whereas it was easy to see in the others. These two families are fairly easy to separate in that in the entomobriety, the fourth abdominal segment is usually at least twice as long as the third segment. And so you can see, especially in these diagrammatic ones, but see how long the fourth segment is as compared to the third segment. These clear over to the right really illustrate it nicely too, how long that fourth segment is. Whereas the isotomidae on the left-hand side, they're all about the same length. Which again, there's our prefix iso, right? Tome means segment, so iso means same. So the same size segments. The entomobriids, these are the largest springtails. The furcula is usually well developed. There's about 138 species in North America. Fairly large and diverse group. And I should mention that in recent times, some of these have been being split off into other families, but usually there are only a few species and they're fairly rare. It's not been things that would affect what we do here, but you should be aware that things that may look like entomobriids may actually be some now small related families. Again, these are generally rare and usually don't occur in our area. Again, isotomidae, I've already talked mostly about it. There's about 200 species in North America. Some of these, Aaron will be interested in this, some of these go through what is called ecomorphosis. And all that is that you may have different body forms or that depending on the temperature. Some isotomids undergo ecomorphosis, which is the production of different morphological forms caused by different temperatures. There's at least one species in the isotomidae that's known to be predaceous on other springtails too. But
so for the ecomorphosis, is it after the egg stage?
Probably, as it's going through its... I don't know. I don't know the details, so... And they're so small. This would be a hard group to work with if you were wanting to take a look at that. But.
I remember Brooke working with Columbo last semester, but I don't remember what she was doing entirely.
Who did?
Brooke.
Yeah, she was running pitfall traps in saline or different soil types in soybeans or stuff, wasn't she? I don't know. So, these can be a pest. Mark Boutel's been having us trying to get Jerry to identify some. There's some that get into the sugar beet fields here in the east, and I think there's one out in the western part of the state that they think is a different species than the one in the east. And so... we're about out of time, but I think a convenient stopping place would be if I go ahead and do the next family, and that'll be the finish the Entonatha, and then we'll start with the Ectonatha next week, which I think we were scheduled to have an exam
the 24th,
which is like, is that Tuesday?
Yeah. Day before my birthday.
Yeah. Well, since we won't be through the material by Tuesday, we're not having the exam by Tuesday.
Okay.
What I would suspect is I will lecture on, finish up the Aterogoda on Tuesday, and we may have time. I may go ahead and start on some new stuff. But I think I would prefer to have the exam the next Tuesday then. So probably not at all next week. Does that work for people? I mean, I can do it. We can get it ready and have... I just like to give you time, lot more time after I finish the material. So it'd either be Thursday or Friday. And Friday we only have lecture. You know, I only can keep you for lecture unless you guys are willing to stay longer. If you'd rather have it on Friday, we could do it Friday. The week after Tuesday.
I'm perfectly fine with either one, really, but week after is something you want.
It's just, and this is, here I am talking about other stuff, but this is just real typical, especially, again, if you guys talk me out into going out collecting again, but I'm always two or three lectures behind in this class, and we're always doing the exams later, and... which means by the time we get to the end of the semester, we have to lecture into the lab periods a little bit to get all the material in. Or
I think we're a bit more okay with that towards the end of the semester, primarily because, well, we probably will have started going through our naming processes and stuff.
Yeah.
There's nothing to collect.
So
going into the lab period for lecture isn't the worst thing in the world.
And I'll be in touch with Ryan. If he listens to this, he'll be hearing this, but... to work it all out on how this is all going to work. But that'd be my preference. Is I'll do the Diplura yet today, and then we'll do the last two orders in the Aterogoda on Tuesday morning. And I probably will go ahead and start on the Pterygoda a little bit. And then we'll plan on having the first exam the following Tuesday. That'd give you a whole week after the material's done to study and prepare for it. So anyway, the Diplura, commonly called Diplurans, or sometimes the family names serve as common names, like the Campadeids or the Japidids. Here's your ending ura again.
Tail.
Remember that? And of course, di means two, or diplo means two. So these are the two-tailed insects, or two-tailed hexapods. and it does refer to that they have a pair of cerci. They differ from the next couple families in that the next couple families have a pair of cerci, but they've got another caudal appendage called the median caudal filament. So they'll have three at the tail end. These only have two. Again, these still have internal mouth parts, so they're still part of the entonatha, mm-hmm. where everything after this will have the external mouth parts. These are fairly small. They're usually larger than Colemblans or Proturans, though, but they're fairly small, usually pale in color. Chewing mouth parts. They lack compound eyes and ocelli. The antennae are relatively long, many segmented. Again, they're primitively wingless. These are interesting. They do have trachea, but they don't have any Malpighian tubules. The excretory waste organs inside the body. So these lack Malpighian tubules. Again, they have the two caudal cerci, but lack the median filament. Now, the cerci, as you can see on this handout, can be in two different forms. They can be long and slender, like you normally think cerci would be, or they can be more forceps-like. These also lack scales on the body. Why that's important is the next two orders kind of have scales or scaly, hairy, scaly bodies, where these are not scaly or hairy. Styli are also found on a lot of the abdominal segments. That handout down at the bottom shows some styli. Again, maybe vestiges of the old leg-like appendages. At one time, these were combined with the Thysanura, but they are quite different. Again, these have the internal mouth parts, where the Thysanura have external mouth parts, and some of the other differences I've already mentioned. These are often found in leaf litter, sometimes under the bark or rotten logs. Again, best chance maybe in Berlazy. A long time ago, when I was at Louisiana State University, a fellow student there with me, he worked on gepidians, the things to the right. And we'd go out collecting, you know, like we've been doing. We'd go out collecting and sweeping everywhere and catching everything. Well, he didn't. He would find a dead tree or an area that had good leaf litter, and he would just dig a big hole down in the ground, carefully moving the dirt, and would just sit there for hours watching in the dirt and this and that. And every once in a while, one of these gepidians would run across. But it seemed like, you know, 3 or 4 hours, a good day for him would be that he'd catch 3 or 4 gepidians, and it'd be, you know, I just wouldn't have the patience to do it. But he actually described some new species, including one that used to occur in caves, a cave-dwelling gepidian and stuff. So these have some resemblance to the symphylans, so you might want to compare with those. The symphylans shouldn't have the, I don't think they had the cerci though, do they? But anyway, you may want to compare those sometime. Should be easy, the gepidians anyway, because the symphylans definitely didn't have the forceps-like cerci. Again, there's 5 North American families, and I've got notes on all of them in here, but the only two that I require is the Campodeids on the left-hand side of the handout and the gepidians on the right-hand side. And you can see those are easy to tell apart. The Campodeids have the long filament-like cerci, and the gepidians have the short forceps-like cerci. If you go back and recall your introductory entomology, and remember there's all these kinds of larval body forms, mm-hmm. or remember a ruciform and yeah, all those. Well, one of them was Campodeiform, and it's named after the Campodeids. That's just kind of a general, long, slender larval form like that. So yeah, if you're trying to remember what campodia form, well, think of campodiids. Or the other way around, if you're trying to think of what the campodiids look like, think of the campodia form. So the Gepidgidae on the right hand side there, easy to recognize because of the forceps like Circe. They have what we call trichobothria on the antennae. Trichobothria are just hairs, but they're often usually sensory hairs. They're not just plain hairs, but they're hairs that kind of have a sensory function. In general, the only other insect group that has forceps like Circe are the earwigs. Remember the earwigs? Or we'll get to the earwigs.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, but the earwigs are usually much larger in size. They often have wings, but not always. And so I really don't think you would confuse these with earwigs at all. There's another family called the Paragepidgidae. Again, there's six species in that one. They essentially are the same as the Gepidgids, but now they lack the trichobothria on the antennae. But again, we're not going to concern ourselves with those. The Campodidae, here the Circe are not forceps-like. They're long and slender. And they're usually fairly long, about half the length of the body. This is the most common family. And he actually included a picture of the Anagepidgidae. It's another one that we don't require. But here you notice the Circe are still filiform, but they're much shorter. They're not half the length of the body. There's another one called the Procampodidae. There's like a couple or species. Only one North American species, and occurs in California. So we're not going to run across it here. And as I said, that's a good stopping place there. We'll do start with the Ectonatha and the Monocondylia, Dicondylia on Tuesday. Any questions before we leave today? Okay, well, I will.
So test not next